Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on producing good food when we come back. Oil and gold and their relative values. You know, to evaluate the cost of anything in a time of falling currency values, we must establish a starting point somewhere in the past as objectively as possible, and when a state of equilibrium existed. It's a time when all of the parties were happy with the price relationships. Well, this writer chooses the year of 1933 as a starting point for the following reasons. First, the dollar was gold and backed, and it was worth 100 cents. Number two, gold was valued at $35 an ounce. Three, oil was valued at approximately $1.50 a barrel. Now, a state of equilibrium existed, and everyone was content with the relative values. Some people will use 1940 or 1950 as a starting point. I contend that these dates are flawed because the dollar was no longer worth 100 cents. Currency values had fallen from the 1933 level. Using the 1933 starting point criteria, 1 ounce of gold bought 23 1/3 barrels of crude oil and a higher quality of crude oil at that. Today's fiat dollar is worth 3 cents, not 100 cents, and it is losing value or purchasing power every day. The inflationary effect is muted by the low cost of imported products from Asiatic countries, such as China. But today's 3 cent dollar equates to oil at approximately $50 a barrel. And today's oil price is approximately $65 plus per barrel as of September of 2005. And today's gold price is approximately $450 an ounce as of September of 2005, which buys about 7 barrels of oil. Notice that compared to 23 barrels of oil back in 1933, today's dollar buys, or today's ounce of gold buys about 7 barrels of oil as opposed to 23 back in 1933. Now, the salient point is this: oil is no longer bought with gold, but rather it's now bought with paper, pseudo money. To equate today's oil prices to gold measured by a rubber yardstick called paper money is a mistake. A return to a state of equilibrium regarding oil, gold, and money, a rigid yardstick must and will ultimately be used, excluding pseudo-money. To receive just 7 barrels of oil for $455, which is the current price for an ounce of gold, suggests something is strongly amiss, and the something is the fact that heaven and hell has been moved to separate gold from the price of oil. At today's artificial gold price, which is massively manipulated by the Federal Reserve and our Treasury departments, the price equilibrium of gold and oil is impossible. Only at much higher gold prices can the linkage be established once again, as it in time will be. Paper currencies are dying around the world, and gold is not dying anywhere. It's just manipulated, a manipulated price. At $455 an ounce for gold, there isn't enough gold in existence to pay for the oil that we use. There are no oil-producing nations extant who would not choose gold over paper in payment for their oil. At $455 an ounce, no gold holder will use gold to buy oil. None. Zero. Using the objective-subjective equilibrium relationship of gold and oil of 23 barrels per ounce of gold, the current price of gold versus oil should be $1,500 an ounce for gold. And to further make the point, if there were a nation willing to pay for oil exclusively with gold, they would be offered upwards of 30 barrels of oil per ounce of gold, in my considered opinion. And 50 barrels of oil for an ounce of gold is not an impossibility. For the higher figures, that would be less than 75 cents a barrel in adjusted inflation. Adjusted 1933 prices. Yes, I'm quite familiar with the oil supply peak oil thesis, much of which is true and much of which is untrue. But since 1933, the oil application usage has been massive and discovery of new deposits has been massive, and it's equal to or greater than today as it was in 1933. For this reality, and I rely on the chief economist of the American Petroleum Institute, the API, representing the massive oil industry in America, based on his statements, the peak oil thesis mouthed by some who should know better is a fraud. It's not a political fraud, it's just a physical fraud. Gold is largely a byproduct of other mining, and demand for gold has risen for the same reason. Demand for oil has risen, and that is giant increases in world population, and everybody wants some. Now, I would speculate gold recovery since the equilibrium year of 1933 has been a lesser percentage than that of oil. Gold is the ultimate means of payment, the ultimate money. It always has been, and I think that it always will be. The gold-oil linkage will always exist despite lapses into foolishness and insanity from time to time. Mud pies are not money. Paper is not money. At today's gold price in paper gold, or in paper rather, gold is yet available for under one half of its equilibrium, $11.65 an ounce. In 1933, equilibrium prices, gold can be bought at about $13.65 an ounce, but it will not always be that way. Now, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury stock is reported to be approximately 8,500 metric tons. It's the largest single national holding in the world. Some credible persons suspect the U.S. does not own that gold at all. Total worldwide gold in existence is thought to be approximately 120,000 tons, of which 27,700 tons is major central bank holdings, with a value of approximately $400 billion, far less than the twin deficits of the United States for a single year, calculated at $450 an ounce. Oil-producing nations sold oil until 1971 for gold by way of the convertibility factor. The final 20 years of oil for gold sales averaged $4 a barrel, a time when the dollar had been losing value for 38 consecutive years by 1971. Central bank gold holdings are and will be sealed from public access always. It has been reported nearly a decade ago that the Saudis were allowing $1,000 an ounce for oil paid for in gold, of which there were very few takers. Now, that tells us that 1 ounce of gold bought close to 100 barrels of oil at that time. Few Takers tells us that the big players would not trade 1 ounce of gold for 14 times the amount of oil that we buy today for the dollar equivalent price of gold at $455 an ounce. The mega gold holding consortiums and central banks who are in the know must then believe that gold is undervalued at $1,000 an ounce, for oil then priced at approximately one-fifth of today's price. Now, when the door slams shut on gold sales to the public by the mints of the world, cheap gold will be opportunity lost. Could total world gold be far less than thought? That could also be true. That's a treatise written by a gold broker named Frank Batten up in Boise, Idaho, who wants to remain anonymous, so I thought I'd share that with you. Yesterday's editorial on the school criticism older than the system is written by David W. Kirkpatrick. I forgot to give you that information yesterday. David W. Kirkpatrick puts out a weekly newsletter free of charge, which is from the U.S. Freedom Foundation, Senior Education Fellow, and their webpage is www.freedomfoundation.us. Again, that's www.freedomfoundation.us. If you were wondering about that story I gave to you yesterday when he was talking about education and Walter Cronkite, Marlon Brando, Woody Allen and others who had commented on school being a terrorist activity. Guy's name is David W. Kirkpatrick at the U.S. Freedom Foundation. All right, we were talking about the production or producing good food. The production of good food starts with the soil. And the big problem that we're having is factory farms and monoculture. Avian bird flu is coming from our monoculture in the same way that mad cow disease came from our factory farms producing milk with bypass protein. Now, bypass protein, I mentioned to you last time, not by that name, but bypass protein began here in the United States as an outgrowth of the decline of protein in grain. You see, animals, that is, farm animals like goats and sheep and cows, and those are called ruminants. They are vegetarian. They eat grain, grass, and other vegetation. Not just grass, they also are browsers, they eat leaves and all kinds of things, but they're vegetarian. And they have to have a vegetarian diet of a minimum of 17% protein, which is naturally available. Deer, for instance, get a 17% protein ration. They're browsers and they eat out in the forest and the woods where the food is natural. Now, farmers do not produce natural food. Farmers produce a hybridized food. It's what we call today in America agribusiness. Agribusiness produces food. Food, in reality, is fuel. We put gasoline in our automobiles. It's called fuel. We put food in our stomachs. It is the fuel that mammals, like human beings, use to propel our bodies. If we don't have this fuel, we will run out of energy and we won't be able to function. Now, the better fuel that you put into an automobile engine, the better it performs. An automobile engine will perform, it will run on diesel or stove oil. Not very well, but it will run on diesel. To illustrate that little story, when I was a kid back in the 1940s, there were tractors known as John Deere tractors. And those John Deere tractors, they weren't the only ones by any means, but they were commonly run on lesser fuels than gasoline. They were four-stroke gasoline engines, and they run best on gasoline, but gasoline cost 17 cents a gallon, and stove oil was 9 cents. So you could run this thing at about half the price. Now, you couldn't get 100% of the efficiency out of it, but you could get about 80 or 90% of the efficiency for 9 cents a gallon, which made it pretty economical. And back during the Depression years of the 1930s, you know, the people were very concerned about economies. So the John Deere Company built a tractor called the John Deere D model, which ran on dieseline, kerosene, diesel, stove oil, or gasoline. So it had two fuel tanks. It had a little 2-gallon gas tank. You put in a couple of gallons. And then it had about a 25-gallon main tank, which we filled up with stove oil. So where I lived, we used stove oil. And we would start it on gasoline, and in the front of the tractor where the radiator was located, there was a louver up there. There was a shutter, just like Venetian blinds. And back in the cockpit where we sat on the seat, there was a screw. And you turned this screw. You turned this knob counterclockwise or clockwise, and it would open the louvers or close the louvers. So here's the way we operated this John Deere tractor. We'd started on gasoline. It wouldn't start on diesel. It won't start on dieseline or kerosene because the octane rating's too low. But it will start on gasoline. So we'd start it on gasoline, and we'd start down the furrow or start down the field with the shutters closed and the air restricted to the radiator. In very short order, the temperature of the engine would rise to 180 degrees. At 180 degrees, we would then switch over from gasoline to diesel. The diesel, stove oil, or kerosene will burn handily at 180 degrees. So when the engine temperature is hot, then the lower octane fuels will burn. Not as efficiently, not as powerfully, but they will burn, and they'll give you about 80 or 90% of the power. And it's more economical. Well, now, human beings are very concerned about economies, economy of scale, profit and profitability. In fact, we're more concerned about money and economy than we are about longevity. So we will buy substandard foods. For instance, we buy hot dogs and hamburger in place of steak and stew meat. And why do we do that? Well, because it's cheaper. There's more of it. It's not as good a fuel, but it's cheaper, and it gives us 80 or 90% of the efficiency. Now, the problem with using lower-grade fuels is that in an engine, it gums them up. It produces a lot of tar. It produces a lot of build up on the valves, and the engines don't last as long. I really question the economy of using diesel and lower grade fuels, even in a tractor, because they wouldn't run as long. You'd have to tear them down. Now, if you take a diesel engine today, they run, in a truck, easily 200,000 miles, and I've seen them run as much as 300,000 miles. Diesel fuel and a diesel engine and a diesel truck, 200,000 or 300,000 miles. Gasoline and a gasoline engine, today they run a lot farther than they used to. When I was a kid, if you got 60,000 miles out of a gasoline engine before you had to rebuild it, that was pretty good. 80,000 was phenomenal. The old Model A Fords would only run about 30,000 miles, and you'd have to put new Babbitts in the bearings. So as time goes on, we get better and better in our efficiencies and technology. And of course, being human, we expect that our bodies ought to work just like automobile and diesel engines. And in fact, we treat them that way today. If your liver gives out, we just put in a new liver. It's kind of like changing an alternator on your car. You're driving down the road and you look down and it's not charging. You pull into a service center and you say, "Hey, my alternator isn't charging." And the guy tests it and he says, "Well, it's wore out." Well, just put on a new one. So for $50, they just put on a new alternator and you drive out. Well, it works for automobiles. Why shouldn't it work for humans? Well, we've been testing that now for the last 50 or 75 years. We're getting pretty good now at these organ transplants. I mean, it's very common today to have kidney transplants. You know, when I was a kid, a kidney transplant was way out in, you know, the stars someplace. It was phenomenal. Today, kidney transplants are just a routine. But now we're getting into more bizarre transplants, like heart transplants and liver transplants and heart, lung, and liver transplants. And the other day, some lady had a face transplant over in France and so on. And it makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? I mean, after all, if you can do it for an automobile, why can't you do it for a human? And they're talking about all kinds of great technological breakthroughs. They're talking about stem cells and making people, you know, who are paralyzed walk again. God, that's marvelous, isn't it? And God, it just sounds so good. I want to buy into the program. Unfortunately, we find that in actual practice, when you have bypass surgery, it reduces you to an invalid for the rest of your life. Bill Clinton has been reduced to an invalid. He's still alive. He's still walking around, but he does not have the same body, the same physical energy, the same physical abilities that he had before the transplant surgery. Where in this case, it was a Roto-Rooter job, I guess. They didn't transplant anything, but they gave him a bypass job. Transplanted some veins out of his legs or arteries out of his legs. And it only lasts for about 5 years. In 5 years, he'll have to have another transplant surgery. And then another transplant surgery. His life expectancy has been reduced very dramatically because you can only do about two or three of those transplant surgeries, and he got his at age 55, so he'll have to have another one at 60, 65, and 70. His chances of living to be 80, 90, 95 years old are not very, very good. Had he gone the natural, organic route and cured that same disease by, oh, let's say, using vitamins and minerals and foods and supplements and so on, he could have accomplished the same thing. And then he would have stood a lot better chance of living to be 75, 80, or 85, or 90, because he would not have had that invasive surgery. Americans today, though, we're the now generation. We got to have it right now. We want to pull into the drive-up window, have it ready for us when we get up to the window, Pam, drive out and eat while we're driving down the road. We haven't got time to go in the restaurant, sit down and have a meal. We're going to eat as we drive. It's the way we are. Now, as a result of that, there are consequences that come from it. I mentioned this to you the last program, that, yes, we have hybrid seeds, and we have chemical fertilizers, and we have sprays that we put on our agricultural monoculture crops, but there are side effects that come from that. In the final analysis, I would question whether or not we're actually making a greater profit by using these chemical fertilizers, which, remember, we started using so that we could save that 1 year out of seven. Let's just try 1, divide that by 7, which is 14%. I think I mentioned that it was 16%. It's actually 14.28%. So God, in the natural system, designed a system that requires a fertilizer input of 14%. I think, boys and girls, when you take a look at the net results of using chemical fertilizers and spray over time, that it amounts to more than 14% input. In fact, I know that it amounts to more than 14%. For instance, I talked to an apple grower one time that said that, they told me that years ago when they first started using spray on apples, they sprayed once or twice a year. He said now they spray 14 times a year. In fact, the cost of the spray and the spraying with the labor at 14 times a year is getting to the point where it's almost economically unfeasible to grow apples. It's the way life is, boys and girls. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story here about an apple. You know, you go out into the orchard, and you pick up an apple, and you look at it very carefully, and you'll notice a little hole in the apple. A little hole. It's going to be a very tiny hole. It'll be about the size of a pencil lead, about the size of the point on your ballpoint pen. Now you take your knife and you cut right through the center of that hole. Cut that apple in half and break it open. And right in the center at the seed, where the seeds are, you'll find a little worm. And that little worm is in there building a little cocoon. It's a moth is what it is. And that little worm is going to turn into a moth. And then he's going to go out and he's going to lay more eggs. Now, normally, when you see that, you say to yourself, oh, my God, it makes me want to puke. And you throw the apple on the ground, and you, it just makes you sick, and you don't want to eat that apple. Because you can just imagine biting into that apple, and there on the apple is half a worm. And there's nothing worse than biting into an apple and finding half a worm. Is there? Now, that is done intentionally. You see, the designer of the apple and the designer of the human being one and the same guy, figured that what he would do is that he would put in a built-in sensor to protect you from eating that apple. He would make that apple so unattractive that you wouldn't want to eat it. Now, the reason that little insect is in there is because that apple is deficient in vitamins and minerals. And that insect, he's not very smart. That insect probably isn't near as smart as you are. And you'd think that human beings would be a lot smarter than a worm, but that worm will only eat apples that are minerally and nutritionally deficient. That same moth, if he gets on an apple that is filled with vitamins and minerals, he won't eat it. Which leads me to believe that we are still searching for intelligent life on planet Earth. It hasn't been discovered yet. We look at the Grand Canyon and we see evolution. We can't see Noah's flood. We look at an apple with half a worm in it, and we cannot see that worm in there is a benefactor. He's a friend. Even if he's only half there, he's a benefactor and a friend. Because the worm is sending us a signal. The worm is telling us that this apple is unfit for human consumption. Unfortunately, apple farmers do not get paid for producing apples with nutrients. Apple farmers get paid for producing bushels of apples. Whether that apple has any nutritional value in it or not is totally irrelevant to the apple farmer. That's not the way he gets paid. So when an apple farmer sees an apple with a little pinhole in it, he sees the worm inside as his enemy. But if you're a consumer who's going to eat that apple and is depending upon that apple for the fuel that you need to eat to propel your body, to keep you from having bypass surgery, cancer, multiple sclerosis, or some other disease, that worm is your friend. Because that worm, as unappetizing as he makes that apple, sends you a signal. And if you have any intelligent life in you, you won't want to eat that apple. which is good. That's good. Those apples that are nutritionally deficient attract the moths who lay the eggs that produce the worms that consume those dead apples. Now, the apples that don't have worms, the apples that are subjected to the same moths, the moths fly around at night, and they inspect all of the apples, and as soon as they find an apple that is nutritionally deficient, they lay eggs on it. The eggs hatch, and they bore into the apple, making the apple inedible to human beings. That's the design mechanism from an intelligent creator to protect you, the consumer of the fuel, from buying fuel that's bad. Now, the farmer wants to deceive you. So the farmer goes to Monsanto or to some chemical company like Standard Oil and says, look, we're having great crop losses. We lose 10, 15, 20% of our apple crop to these worms. So, again, some bright young fellow, probably born in Los Angeles, Chicago, or Philadelphia, who has gone to college, looks at the problem and says, aha, the city kid, without any native intelligence, looks at the problem and says, obviously, we need to find a way to kill that worm. So he comes up with DDT or some other chemical compound. Some miracle chemical. And he tests it. And sure enough, it just kills that worm dead. So he goes to his boss and he says, look at what I've discovered. And his boss pats him on his little pointed head and he says, my God, you are a brilliant scientist. You have discovered DDT. The savior of mankind. You have saved man from starvation. And, of course, this young fellow, you know, born in the city, went to college, became a chemist, goes to work for Monsanto, discovers DDT, gets paid a bonus for his work. Monsanto goes into production, they make DDT, and they go to the farmer, and they say, look, are you having corn borers eat your corn? Spray it with DDT. It kills all the insects. Of course, it kills all the bees that pollinate the insects also. But it kills the corn borers. It kills the apple borers. And the farmer, he sprays his apples, he sprays his apple trees, and it kills all of the worms, and he gets all of the apples, and there's no pinholes, and there's no worms in the apples. And you as a consumer love it, and you eat the apple. Now, of course, this apple only has half the copper, or half the iron, and half the boron, and half the protein, and half the nutrients, half the fuel value. It's like burning stove oil in a John Deere tractor. It's only about 80% efficient, but it runs. I mean, my God, you eat the apple, and you can still go to work. You can still get energy. You've still got carbohydrates in there. You've still got nutrition. It's not as much. It's not near as good as gasoline. But, hell, you know, for the money that you're spending in the cheap food and the economy of scale for the farmer and the economy of price for the consumer, it's wonderful, isn't it? Now, of course, this DDT is a residue on the apple. So you get a little DDT, which resides in your fat cells. Over time, these chemicals build up in your body. Of which, by the way, there are now 87,000 chemicals in our environment. Now, that's here in the United States. I can't speak for the rest of you people. But here in the United States, we have 87,000 chemicals that are manufactured and produced every day in our environment. Now, in 1900, the rate of cancer in this country was 1 in 33. Today, it's 1 in 2. 50% of all of you people listening to my voice right this minute will develop cancer in your lifetime. Just look around the room. How many people are in the room? Every other one of you, 50%, half of you, are going to develop cancer in your lifetime. And they predict that by the year 2020, it'll be one out of one. Everybody in the room is going to develop cancer in his lifetime. Now, if that's what you want, It's a choice that you have to make. If that's what you want, by God, we have reached utopia. This is heaven on earth. Everybody gets cancer. Nobody's left out. God, I long for the day when everybody can have bypass surgery. Nobody's left out. Now, for my money, you can have my share of cancer and you can have my share of bypass surgery. I prefer the little moth that runs around laying the little eggs that produce the little worms that warn me that this apple is not fit for human consumption. You don't get that in the supermarket. You get these nice red and green, yellow apples, and there's no little signs in there. You cannot tell whether this apple is nutritionally good or bad. Now, God, the designer, designed a methodology to tell us. If you pick up an apple and it's got a little pinhole in it, it's not fit for human consumption. Throw it down on the ground. Throw it in the garbage. And if it has passed the moth test, if the moth has crawled all over the apple, didn't lay any eggs, and no worm has bored a hole into the apple, that's a good apple to eat. It has passed the worm test. Once you spray it with DDT or some other chemical, you can't tell. You've killed the messenger. That little worm, boys and girls, is the messenger. Now, we're doing the same thing here with our feedlots. We're doing the same thing here with our factory farms, raising pigs and poultry. We're doing this with our monoculture, with our corn and our wheat. And now we've got these genetically modified organisms. I mean, hell, we're just going to splice on to wheat and corn and tomatoes, whatever it is that we want. We, in short, we humans, are going to improve upon God's creation. Now, if you're born in the city and you went to public school and you were taught evolution, it makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? You're not the product of a creator who designed apples with insects to tell you which apples are good for food, for fuel, and which aren't. You just evolved from green sap, in a hot pool somewhere in an ocean environment, and you just happened to be here. And without any God, then there wasn't any design with that worm on the apple or with the corn borer in the corn. And so it makes all the sense in the world that we should be at war with the insects. Truth of the matter is, insects aren't your adversaries. The insects are your friends. Those ticks that are down there jumping on you in the woods, they're sending you a signal. It says your body's weak. You need to strengthen your body. You need to fix what's wrong with it. You know, when you're having chest pains, you don't need bypass surgery. You're getting a warning signal. The pain says there's something wrong here. You've got atherosclerosis. You need to clean out your arteries. Well, before you can do that, shouldn't you ask the question, what caused my arteries to plug up? What causes my arteries to plug up? You know, a person gets cancer, he goes to the doctor. I'm not quite sure why people want to go to the doctor when they have cancer, but they do. When they go to the doctor, they ask the doctor, can you tell me what's wrong with me? And the doctor looks you over real good, gives you some tests, charges you a ton of money, and says, you have cancer. And that's like a death sentence. And you say, oh my God, doc, tell me anything, but tell me that I don't have cancer. And the doc says, no, now you got cancer. And so you say, what causes cancer? And the doctor says, I don't know. But doc, you've been to college. Doc, you're smart. Surely you must know what causes cancer. No, my son. We don't know what causes cancer. It's a mystery beyond the reach of science. Doc, can you cure it? And the doc says, no, we can't cure it. But doc, you're smart. You went to college and you're real intelligent. Surely you must be able to cure cancer. And the doctor says, no, cancer is beyond the realm of science and we can't cure it. And you say, Doc, does it mean there's no hope? What can I do? And the doc says, oh, no, you got lots of hope. We have a treatment. We have a regimen. We have a procedure. For $100,000, we can treat your cancer. Oh, thank God, Doc. When do I start? And the doc says, well, I've got chemotherapy. I can cut you. I can burn you. I can poison you. Will the cancer go away? No. No, you're going to die, but we can keep you alive for 18 months for $100,000. My wife had that experience. She had cancer. Went to the doctor and said, yeah, you're going to die, lady. And then she said, well, how long have I got? And they said, well, about 3 to 6 months. And they said, well, with chemotherapy, though, and with modern drugs and surgery and so on, we might be able to stretch that out for 18 months. And my wife said, let's see if I understand this. If I pay you $100,000, you can keep me alive for 18 months. Yes, we think that's possible. And she says, well, are you going to cure me? No, I'm going to die anyway. Yep. Well, then my family could probably use the $100,000 just as well as you can, and probably better, and probably need it more. Therefore, I think I'll save the $100,000, die in 3 to 6 months, and let my family have the money. Because, you know, what the hell is the difference? If I'm going to die in 3 to 6 months, what the hell is the difference? 6 months? A year? 18 months? I don't have any future. So she went home, and she got to thinking about it a little bit, you know, and she got to, well, what causes this cancer? I must have done something. Not everybody gets cancer. Some people don't get it. Not every apple gets this worm. Why is it that some apples don't get worms? And so as she did a little research, she found out that her body was weak. Her body was sick. She didn't get enough nutrients. She's eaten too many of those apples that had been sprayed that had not gone through the worm test. And her body was short of a number of vitamins and minerals. And so she started taking vitamins and minerals. And she started eating wheatgrass. She got on to a natural regimen. That was 28 years ago. She still has cancer. She's had it for 28 years. And she's going to die with cancer. She hopes that she doesn't die of cancer. She just knows that when she does die, she's going to have it. Because once you get it, you've always got it, and you're going to die with it. It's a hell of a lot better to live your life without ever getting cancer than it is to get it and then have to live with it. But that's the breaks of the game. Now, you can live with it, and you can control it, and you can manage it, and that's a story of and by itself. But it goes back to that soil, boys and girls. It goes back to those land Sabbaths and Jubilees. It goes back to those hybridized seeds. I mean, these are choices that we have to make. And we make choices. Now, we need chickens. I think eggs are really pretty good. But by the time you eat those eggs after you've got 28 chemicals put in them, I'm not sure that those eggs are near as good for you as they could be. Now, I told you last time about louse. They've got chickens in louse, and they don't have avian bird flu. They had it. They had it on the big factory farms. Now, they've got it on the big factory farms in China, Vietnam, and Thailand, which surrounds Laos. It has spread to Europe. It will come to the United States. It's going to be a worldwide problem. It's going to be a man-caused worldwide problem, and it's going to scare the living hell out of you, and you're going to line up to get your vaccines. I'm not. And I'm not going to go down to get my vaccines. I'm going to concentrate on building my immune system so that my body can ward off that virus. Boys and girls, there are ticks all over the forest. And moving from this location to another location is not going to protect you from ticks. But a strong, healthy body will protect you from ticks wherever you go. And a strong, healthy body, a strong, healthy immune system will protect you and your body from avian flu wherever you go. Viruses and germs, boys and girls, are in the air. They're in the food. They're in the soil. They're everywhere. And the solution to good health is a strong immune system. And a strong immune system starts with good, healthy soil, which produces good food. And good food is what produces strong, healthy bodies with strong, healthy immune systems. That's where health is located. Good health is located in good soil, which produces good food, which produces good bodies, which produces good health. That's the way that game is played. Now, of course, we're not interested in good health. We're interested in good quick fixes. So, like a Bill Clinton, you eat junk food. Junk food plugs up your arteries. Remember, Bill Clinton was a great fan of junk food. He liked McDonald's. Okay. Well, that has a consequence to it, because, you see, there's a statute that our God, our Creator, gave us. It makes all kinds of sense. And the good sense that it makes is, you shall eat no manner of fat. You'll see that in Leviticus 3, verse 17. It's one of the fat statutes. I'll look that up, because there's two of them. I'll give them both to you. Two fat statutes. Leviticus 3, verse 17, has a corollary. Fat number 3. So let me turn over here to fat number 3. And Leviticus 7, verses 22 through 27. So you got two statutes. Leviticus 3, verse 17, and Leviticus 7, verses 22 through 27, tell you not to eat animal fat. And why is that? Well, it's because your body, if you're a human being like I am, your body is not designed to digest fat. That does not mean that you don't need fat, and that does not mean that your body doesn't need fat, and doesn't mean that their body can't digest all fats. It just doesn't digest animal fat. I'll read it to you. It's in Leviticus 7. What did I say it was now? Let me refer back here to number 3, verse 22. So 7, verse 22, and we get a little story here. And the Eternal spoke unto Moses, saying, you speak unto the children of Israel, and you tell them, you shall eat no manner of fat of ox, or of sheep, or of goat. And the fat of the beast that dies of itself, and the fat of that which is torn with beasts, may be used in any other use. You can make candles out of it. You can make soap out of it. But you shall in no wise eat of it. For whosoever eats the fat of the beast, of which men offer an offering made by fire unto the Eternal, even the soul that eateth it shall be cut off from his people. And moreover, you shall eat no manner of blood, whether it be of fowl, or of beast, or any of your dwellings. Whatsoever soul it be that eateth any manner of blood, even that soul shall be cut off from his people. So God puts a penalty with it, and he says, we're going to excommunicate you. We are going, you know, if you had a guy that ran around picking his nose and eating it, what would you think of that? Is that the kind of guy that you want around you? I mean, you know, it's kind of gross, isn't it? And if you saw some guy and he was catching rats and he was skinning rats and he was baking them and cooking them and eating them, you know, you'd kind of want to, you know, steer clear of that guy. I'm kind of that way. I kind of steer clear of people, you know, that birds of a feather flock together, you know. And so I kind of stick with people that eat like I do. Vegetarians kind of stick with vegetarian people, and, you know, people that eat meat kind of stick with people that eat meat. God comes along and he says, now don't eat fat and don't eat blood. Now, why do you suppose he told us that? Is it because he just wanted to spoil fun? He just wanted to wreck your day, rain on your parade? Because, you know, fat has a lot of calories. You know, fat has a lot of nutrition in it. So if you're some guy that's born in the city and you went to college and studied biology and you got a degree and went to work for Monsanto, or you went to work for Jimmy Dean, Pure Pork Sausage, or you went to work for the Department of Agriculture, hey, it just makes all the sense in the world to take a waste byproduct like fat and then mix 40% of it into the hot dogs and sell them at the ballpark. It takes a waste product and uses it and makes something constructive with it. Something that really tastes real good. Unfortunately, as in the case of Bill Clinton, he was eating McDonald's hamburgers, which have only 30% fat. 30% by law, by the way. 30%. Your legislature mandates 30% fat in the hamburger, 40% in the hot dog. And you eat that, and then it gets into your arteries, and then it gives you atherosclerosis. It plugs up your arteries. We know that. It's scientific. Now, Moses didn't know that, and the Israelites didn't know that. And if you've got a bitch with God, you ought to complain to him and say, well, why didn't you explain atherosclerosis to us? And I suppose it's because the average Joe Sixpack can't even spell atherosclerosis. So what the hell do you need to have God explain it to you? He just told you don't eat it. What more do you need? Well, you know, if you're born in the city and you went to college, you got to have an explanation. Well, let me give it to you. See, we have a thing called cholesterol. There's good cholesterol and there's bad cholesterol. And this animal fat's filled with all this bad cholesterol. And it gets into your arteries, and then it plugs them up. And ultimately, it gives you a heart attack, and you die. Now, my grandfather died from a massive heart attack at age 61. Let me describe his malady to you. He had a wonderful wife, my granny, my grandmother. She killed him. One teaspoon at a time. But my grandmother killed my grandfather. She killed him with what she fed him. But it was all right with him because he wouldn't have it any other way. Now, he smoked Roy Tan cigars, he chewed day's work tobacco, and he ate prodigious quantities of strawberry ice cream, along with much animal fat in the bacon and the sausage that he ate every morning. He loved it. It tasted good. He ate it. It felt good going down. One night he went to bed and he wasn't feeling too good. And all of a sudden he stiffened out, my grandmother said. And then he said, up, up. And he stiffened out. He couldn't get up. He was having a heart attack. And she said, and his face became very flushed, very red. He grimaced. He was in great pain. Then he finally relaxed, and he was dead. Oh, naturally, she called the doctor. She called the ambulance. They rushed him to the hospital, and they did a code blue or whatever they did. And you know, ultimately, it was, you take him down to the Anchor Funeral Chapel, and we'll bury him at age 61. Bill Clinton was a little more fortunate. Now, we live in good times. This is the best country in the world to have a heart attack in. This is the best country in the world for heart transplants. I mean, you can't beat America. But I would suggest that you consider this one simple statute, one simple law. If you don't eat any animal fat, I mean, you cut it out of your diet, your chances of having a heart attack are going to diminish dramatically. Now, remember I mentioned my granddad ate prodigious quantities of strawberry ice cream. That was his favorite. Remember, the strawberry ice cream is pasteurized. Pasteurized. And when you pasteurize milk, you destroy the enzyme. Now, this is a scientific fact. There's an enzyme in milk, just a natural enzyme, a digestive enzyme that's in milk that you need to digest milk. This is why you people who are lactose intolerant, you cannot drink milk, you see, because you can't digest it. Hey, you're getting real smart there. We're starting to see some intelligent life spring forth on planet Earth. That's right. And when you pasteurize it, you kill the enzyme. That's why you can't drink milk, because you're lactose intolerant. Some people can digest the milk because they've got enzymes that can digest the milk independent of the lactose intolerant people, but many people are lactose intolerant. Now, you lactose intolerant people, you can digest raw milk. You don't know that because you've never drank raw milk, because you can't get it, because it's against the law. You can't get raw milk. You, most of you people listening to me right now, have never drank a glass of raw milk. In fact, you wouldn't on a bet, because you've already been brainwashed into believing it's bad for you. But let me tell you that long before pasteurization came along, people were drinking raw milk. And they weren't dying from heart attacks. And they weren't lactose intolerant. Lactose intolerance is something that's new. That just came along in the last 50 years or so. That hasn't been around forever. But it's around now, because when you pasteurize the milk, you destroy the enzyme that you need to digest the milk. So here's my granddad. He's eating this strawberry ice cream without the enzyme to digest it, so the fat becomes the same as animal fat, goes into his arteries and plugs them up. And of course, the nicotine in the day's work tobacco didn't help him a great deal either, did it? See where we're going with good food? Now, we can take one more giant leap, and let me make this statement. If you've got a symptom, it's caused by one, bad food, you're starving to death, or two, bad food, you're being poisoned to death. So what you're putting into your mouth is either one, a poison, or two, it's a food that is lacking nutrition. That's what causes disease, dis-ease, ill at ease. I don't feel good. I'm feeling bad. I'm feeling poorly. A neighbor over here died not too long ago. Asked his sister. I said, "What happened to old Charlie?" And she said, "Oh, they just doctored him to death." What happened to old Charlie? They just doctored him to death. That means iatrogenic disease. That means they poisoned him. Doctors are great at poisoning. See, they give you these pills and sulfides and sulfates and all of these chemicals and potions that they get from the pharmaceutical industry. That's poison. They'll have side effects. And what they're hoping to do is that they don't give you too much of this poison, which will counteract some other poison that you got from Monsanto or from Dow Chemical or somebody else. 87,000 of them. And that's why Americans today are so sick. 99% of us have symptoms. 99% of us, boys and girls, are sick. Which is exactly what my wife told me about 20 years ago. She said, "God, you are sick." And I was. But I recovered. Well, all right, boys and girls, I've got to leave it right there. I've got to give you a final reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school or The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, talking about producing good food. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.